when you have that mindset and that, I guess, grit and hustle in you, you'll figure out how to get through anything. So as I'm building this sales career, I start making a little money. I try to keep up with the Joneses. I buy a couple nice watches and the nice cars. And then I quickly realized that those things didn't fulfill me and they cost me a lot of money and got rid of all of them very quickly. And then started talking to a friend of mine who had a good CPA. And he said, how much are you paying in taxes? And I'm starting to see you make this money.
Welcome to Passive Income Unlocked, where we unlock the doors to intelligent, hands-off real estate investing. We talk to experts in the space about what they do, how they do it, and most importantly, why they do it. My passion is careful, intelligent investing and closing the investing gap one investor at a time. While money doesn't buy happiness, passive income does have the potential to buy back your time. What would you choose to do with your time if you had enough passive income to live your best life? How would you like to spend your days? What kind of impact would you like to make? I'm here to tell you, dream big. There's no ceiling. It's all possible if you take consistent action towards your goals. It's been said that success is 80% mindset and 20% strategy. So we discuss both. Ready to gain knowledge and take action? Let's dive in.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the show.
Today, I'm super excited to have Chris Roberts on the show. Chris, thanks for coming on.
Sunja, thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. All right, everyone. So Chris is the founder and CEO of Sterling Rhino Capital. Chris has been a full-time entrepreneur and investor since 2007. He owns and operates a multi-million dollar sales and marketing company, a property management business, and is partner in a point of sale software company. And as you can see, Chris has just a ton of experience in a lot of different areas. Chris, I want to turn it over to you. Take us back in time. Tell us a bit about how you got started in business, how you transitioned to real estate, and an overview of how you got to where you are today.
Of course. It's my pleasure, and I really appreciate the time. I know it's extremely valuable for everyone. So thanks for sitting in, and hopefully we can drop some knowledge bombs for you, the takeaway to help you be more successful out there. I would be remiss if I didn't start with how I kind of had the entrepreneurial bug at a very, very early age, whether it was washing cars and hiring my neighbor in like the third grade to help wash cars and pay him 20% of my profits, or selling candy at school, paper routes and all of that. And then being on my own at a very young age where I was taught that if you wanted something, you had to go out and earn it and figure out how to get it because there just wasn't any resources to get what we wanted. You had to go out and figure it out on your own. So I was out on a very young age, came across a mentor at about the age of 18. I had been on my own for several years at that point. And this person just kind of put me on the right path. He handed me books like How to Win Friends and Influence People and Seven Habits of Highly Effective People and many others that kind of got my mindset on the right track. And at that age, when you're really moldable and you're susceptible to good or bad influences, it was perfect timing for me. So he put me on the right path. He was a CPA who had opened up a business and really just kind of said, look, I believe in your energy and your enthusiasm and your attitude. And from there, I can teach you how to do great things, but you're going to have to put in the work and you're going to have to listen. And so I just kind of took that extremely seriously at the time and just put in a lot of hours, any time that I could put in by, you know, being near this individual, be it working out at his property or working extra hours at his business. I did whatever I could just to have some of that wisdom rub off on me. And at the time, I did not understand how valuable that would be. Only now can I look back and say, wow, I don't know what my life literally would have turned out like without a mentor in it. And at the time, didn't even know what a mentor was. I just knew that he was very humble, and I just aspired to have the things that he had, and they had nothing to do with monetary things. It was the happiness, the hard work ethic, the, you know, go get it, solve the problem attitude. And I really loved that because I didn't have those kind of influences in my life at an early age. So he put me on the right path to a sales career, eventually went out and built a great sales and marketing company. From there, as I started making a little extra money, realized that I had to keep as much of that money as possible. And that's where I was turned from the stock market into real estate investments and started escalating from there. So here I am today.
That's very awesome. And sorry if I missed this, but how did you meet that individual?
You won't believe this story. I tell it, people kind of laugh about it. As a matter of fact, he made a joke about it the other day. We're still in contact. I was actually working at a hot dog cart, and I had all these people in line, and he would come every weekend. I didn't know it, but about the third or fourth weekend, he noticed me and he pulled me aside and asked me if I'd like an opportunity. And I thought he was joking. I actually asked him, you know, do you sell knives door to door? Why would you want to hire a guy like me? Like, what do I have to offer? I worked at a hot dog cart. And he said, no, you don't get it. You know, and I alluded to this earlier. It's your attitude, it's your energy. I can't teach that. What you have is, he said to me, what you have is special, which I had never identified as special. I just was doing what I do. And he said, but I can teach you how to be great. I can teach you how to be a manager. I can teach you how to be an owner someday. Just give me an opportunity. And I just was blown away by that. I mean, no one had ever treated me that way, especially in a professional world. So we negotiated a little bit back and forth, and I went on to work for him. And he was the most significant game changer, tipping point, influencer of my entire life to this date, for sure. So that's how I got to working for him.
That's pretty amazing. And do you know what it was that he saw in you?
Well, I'll tell you almost exactly what he said. I actually wrote about this at one point. He said to me, I've been here for 3 or 4 weeks in a row. You don't know me. He said, but I've watched the way you deal with customers. I've watched the interactions. I've watched literally 50 people in line. And I personally, he said, was kind of stressed out for you because it was so busy. Every weekend I would come, it was so busy. He said, but you never showed that. You were calm and collected. You were having fun. You looked like you were just in your place of comfort. You were, he said, it was amazing to watch. And he said, and this is his kind of his words. He said, you exuded what I wish I had in other employees. And I know that you don't have the skill sets I'm looking for, but you have something else I can't find that I'm willing to teach, right? I'm willing to teach around it. In those words, sort of, so to speak, that's pretty much the way he highlighted my skill set, I guess. And sure enough, you know, I went to work for him. And of course, there was lots of trial and error and pain and suffering. But he taught me a lot about business and performas and spreadsheets and analyzing and building templates and pamphlets and manuals and all that. And I went on and he molded me into a true business professional. So basically, I kind of long-winded that. But he was basically saying that it was your attitude, your energy, your ability to deal with people that was so valuable to him.
Yeah, that's pretty incredible. And an amazing story. So just because it's so important kind of where we come from, you mentioned that you didn't have a lot of folks like that kind of pushing you forward in that way in your life. Will you talk a little bit more? I know you're an open book, about what kind of history you had as a child.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's really relevant and not talked enough about, because that's the foundation of who we are. You know, oftentimes we see people in a professional setting, or we see the money they have or the cars they drive, and we assume that they must have it all, and they don't. And then there's others that live a very simplistic life, and you assume that they have nothing, when in actually they're rich beyond all of our wildest dreams, right? Be it emotional, physical, mental, financial, whatever. So for me, I was out on my own at a very young age, because my mom really was basically a single parent. Her mom and dad had me at the age of 15. They were separated, and I kind of struggled through moving around a lot, staying with aunts and uncles and living with friends and things like that. Was jumped by, you know, rough groups of kids several times as a kid, and just really was having a hard time building confidence and to figure out who I was. And fortunately, she actually moved us out of Southern California to Southern Oregon at about the age of 15. I moved out on my own about 6 months later when she went back to California. I just made the choice to try to figure out how to do it on my own. Had some friends at that point in time that were a little bit older and kind of struggled through the process at that time. And it's interesting. I wouldn't have it any other way. I never had the brothers and sisters. You know, I didn't have really the support system to, in my mind at the time, be successful or be anything. But to circle back around to this hot dog cart concept, or this whole process in my life that I went through, what was interesting is those challenges I went through, the lowest of lows, being jumped by kids or being picked on because I didn't have the Vans that everybody had. Those are shoes, by the way, for the listeners. In Southern California, that was the thing, was having Vans, man. How I wish I would have had a pair of those. It taught me skills that I probably couldn't have even learned through a college degree, and that was people skills, building friendships and struggling through being part of groups that didn't want you as part of their groups. How do you do that? How do you break through those walls? You have to figure out how to be a really good communicator. You have to add value to those kids' lives in order to be welcomed into their groups. Be it a four-square game or something, if you're not really good, they don't pick you till last, right? I was picked last all the time. So I had to figure out, how do you get around that? And those skills served me well working at the hot dog cart, because I didn't realize at the time, but through years of those trials and tribulations, I had developed those sort of people skills and communication skills. And most of all, had an attitude of can do every day, even though I didn't look like I could do anything. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, it's an incredible story of resilience. And I mean, just look at you
today, you know, I mean, I would never have ever dreamed that you would have lacking in confidence. It's just amazing. So congratulations on that personal journey, you know.
Sure.
So you started a sales and marketing career. And I know you mentioned that you wanted to figure out how to keep more of that. And that was one of the reasons why you turned to real estate. Can you speak more to that idea and why it is you turned to real estate?
Yeah, of course. I think at the end of the day, most people they're caught up in the wheel, the hamster wheel, right? We always talk about it. It's like, we can't get out of our own way. We don't know what we don't know. And we're just milling along. And the next thing you know, we look back and we're like in our 80s and we're sore and we don't want to do anything other than sit around and watch reruns of Three's Company or whatever. And I think for me, I always had that. And again, this comes from that young age of struggle, but I always had that attitude of, I've got to outwork everyone around me so that nobody can come up and take my job, right? If I outwork, out hustle, out grind, no one will be able to catch me and take what I've earned, what's mine. I had that at a young age, that hustle, that grit, if you will, right? Even at the hot dog cart, I worked 6 days a week. I mean, you know, tips and making 50, 60 bucks a day. Like, I was making more money than anyone I knew. And I worked at a hot dog cart. It was funny. I think at the end of the day, when you have that mindset and that, I guess, grit and hustle in you, you'll figure out how to get through anything. So as I'm building this sales career, I start making a little money. I try to keep up with the Joneses. I buy a couple nice watches and the nice cars. And then I quickly realized that those things didn't fulfill me and they cost me a lot of money and got rid of all of them very quickly. And then started talking to a friend of mine who had a good CPA. And he said, how much are you paying in taxes? And I'm starting to see you make this money. So I started investing in the stock market and I realized, well, I'm still paying the tax man X amount of dollars. So I happened to have another dinner with a different friend maybe a year later. And this is just moving along. And he says, you got to be in rental properties. And I said, oh, rental property, nah, stock market. And so he and I break out these napkins around this conversation. And lo and behold, after you have these cost segregation studies or even just regular depreciation, and you're investing and you're writing off these expenses and you're using this cash flow, especially if you're an independent contractor like I was at the time, where I had additional incomes that I could offset my losses against those additional incomes because I'm not a W-2 employee, there was this huge benefit of keeping more of that capital versus, you know, spending money on things that don't make you money. They cost you money, right? Like depreciating assets like cars and watches and things versus investing in something that appreciates and kicks out cash flow that you can offset the income on, which means basically you're keeping more of your money. There's one more little parallel to that I'd like to mention is, you know, oftentimes I remember this, especially when I first started coming up in the world, I would look at people that had landscapers, right? Or housekeepers or whatever, or drivers for that matter. And I would say, oh, look at those wealthy people. You know, they look at what they do. And I had no idea why they did it. Now I know the reason they do it is because they make $350 an hour and it makes no sense for them to do landscaping at $15 an hour, right? It's the same thing. Keep more of your money. They're out producing $350 an hour, right? While they pay someone else to produce $10 an hour. And that makes sense. So I think it's just understanding your environment and your model and just saying, hey, how hard do I want to work? You know, John Dumas said the other day on a podcast, you know, I was working till the middle of June and I was paying taxes all the way through June. And then I finally started making money. And that's ridiculous, right? Nobody wants to do that.
Yeah. I think you explained that really well. It sounds like your sales and marketing company was incredibly successful. So how big did it, I'm just curious, like how big did it get? How many employees did it have?
Well, what's great about the sales and marketing industry is by and large, it's the single individual, the primary, I guess, CEO, vice president, whoever it is, that's driving the vehicle. For me, it was about growing the account base and then hiring people to help manage those accounts. So let's say, for example, I pick up a line of product and it's zero, but the product is incredible. Problem is that company can't get in with 30, 40, 50, 60 accounts in the environment that they want to be in. Let's pick a territory like Washington State. Well, how do they do that? They get there through an influential sales rep or sales and marketing company. And then that person actually can get their foot in the door to present those products. Well, if you can get your clients to bring those products on, it's very likely that if you have a good relationship, you follow through and do your job, that they're going to want to do more business with you, even if you bring in other products. And that's how I started to build my career out. So we picked up multiple lines. We started developing volume. I mean, we took one line of product from zero to 12.5 million in just 4 years, right?
And can you just give an example of like what a product might be?
Yeah, let's use furniture. Okay. So let's say you're representing a furniture line and you go out and you sell a sofa. Well, you get a commission for that. Okay. It's like a retail salesperson. They sell a sofa. They get a commission for that. The difference is here is the volume is escalated by the scale of retailers you bring on and the product, how many products they carry and how much they sell those products, right? For example, you can make a commission off selling one item, but if you can sell one item and then someone else can sell 20 items for you off that one item, you just made a commission on 20 items, not one item. It's kind of the Amazon effect, right? Selling online and things like that. So you're increasing your velocity of income and lowering your overhead. So it doesn't require a huge team to sell these products. It requires good relationships and high velocity, right? The lifetime value of a customer. That's what this is all about. And we just duplicated that over time. And then on a total side note, I picked up a lot of marketing lines. I literally sold at one point more cable TV spots than the local cable rep had sold. It was like 95,000 spots because I was a representative that had the relationships with the retailers.
Pretty amazing. So if I understand it correctly, you're taking the profits from your sales and marketing company and putting that into real estate investments to sort of take advantage of the tax benefits. Is that correct?
This show is sponsored by Lux Capital Investment Group. Lux Capital provides pre-vetted, highly favorable investment opportunities on a risk-adjusted basis. Our opportunities are diversified across asset classes, geographies, and operators. We are nothing short of rigorous in our approach to evaluating investments. We focus on downside protection, conservative underwriting, recession-resistant asset classes, and forging strong relationships with operating partners and investors. If you want to be an intelligent, hands-off investor and gain access to the types of deals that I like to invest in personally, make sure to go to lux-cap.com, L-U-X-E-cap.com, and sign up for our newsletter.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Because you can't stop your primary source of income and being taxed on it. You have to find shelters for that money. So you're either investing them in stocks or you're investing them in real estate. Those are the two primary investments, or at least were anyways. And any way that you can do that and keep reinvesting while you take advantage of the depreciation or expenses associated, you can take those write-offs and pay less taxes.
Awesome. So why do you think you had this grit and sort of entrepreneurship from an early age? Can you attribute that to anything?
Well, you know, what's interesting is, and I actually talk to people a lot about the concept of, you know, how do you build success? You know, what does success look like? It's so different for everybody. And for me, at an early age, and the reason why was I looked at some people that had success and it was given to them. I just observed things because I was out on my own. So while everyone was, you know, going to their senior proms or whatever, or going to college, I was working three jobs. That's just, so I was observant. I was working around a lot of people, busy people, business people. And I just observed that some people had things handed to them, others didn't. Some people had college degrees, others didn't. But the one common denominator was the people that had stuff, they put in the work. And that wasn't a hard thing to do. You just had to show up, right? And so at an early age, I realized, gosh, you know, if I could just put in the work and just continue to show up, eventually I'll learn more stuff and I'll get more efficient and better at this putting in the work thing. And then hopefully I'll get paid for that. The original thought was, if I work 16 hours, I get twice the income of 8 hours, right? But what I didn't realize is that more opportunities like the hot dog cart thing would gravitate towards me because of the work ethic and the attitude. And that's ultimately how I built the foundation of all of my businesses was, if I show up earlier than everyone, I leave later than everyone, I smile all the time, I volunteer all the time, I literally get coffee for anyone that wants it as though I'm like a busboy or something. Eventually, everyone will like me so much that they'll just want to be around and do business with me. That was kind of my early thought process when I saw other people doing similar things in different ways. And then I watched the majority of people that just didn't want to put that work in. They didn't want to do the extra. And they made their few dollars an hour and they went home and they watched reruns of TV shows. And that just wasn't me. So
yeah, definitely super inspiring. So Chris, I know you've done a lot of work building teams. What would you say are some of the greatest lessons or things you want to share with the listeners about how to build teams?
Teams are so important. And it actually took me a long time to realize how important. And here's what I mean by that. If you're an entrepreneur or you're a hustler or a go-getter or someone that aspires to be a business owner or whatever, it's natural to want to do it all yourself because you're the only one in your head. You're the one who has the idea. You're the one who knows where you want to go. But you'll quickly realize that it doesn't matter how good you are. Every successful CEO, every, you know, Richard Branson and Bill Gates and whoever had other people around them. It could have been a significant other, right? It could have been a family member. It could have been a president, vice president, team, whatever. And you have to quickly identify as soon as possible what you really, really love to do, but also what you're good at. Passion is part of it, right? Because if you're good at it, likely you like it. Like, I'm good at it. I practice it. I do it a lot. And then start surrounding yourself with people that will fill those puzzle pieces around your business model you're trying to execute. So let's just use multifamily, for example. If I want to build a multifamily asset, there is a ton of work that goes into that. I think people underestimate that. Number one being raising capital for those assets, right? Number two being asset management and actually running the process. So you have to figure out, if I'm the spreadsheet person, I got to learn that really, you know, learn that. I love it. And I'm going to do it right and do it well all the time. And then I'm going to find that person who really likes asset management or has people skills and wants to deal with the investor relations stuff. And then we are all going to educate each other. We're going to share books. We're going to mastermind. We're going to think tank and do all that. And that's the beginning of building a good team. But don't go it alone, even if it's one other person, because if anything, they're going to be your equalizer. They're going to tell you when something is stupid or doesn't make sense. And you need to be mature enough to absorb that and take that constructive criticism and grow from it.
Yeah, for sure. That's such important advice. And it's hard, I think, to really wrap your mind around that when you're getting started. It can be, you know, but it's so important to remember to compliment, have teammates that compliment each other. And I love that. So tell us a little bit about managing properties during COVID. I know you had some assets that you were purchasing and working on bringing up the NOI. Tell us how that went.
Yeah. Wow. COVID. What a challenge, man. I mean, you just can't even imagine our lifetime something like that would happen. What's interesting is there was a lot of fear mongering out there going on during that, during the COVID implementation, like, oh, COVID's coming and what are we going to do? How are we going to buy assets? And I had been negotiating a deal before COVID that took 11 months to close, and we closed during COVID. And then we had a few other assets we closed. The primary challenges were securing good debt. You know, the reserves went way up. And then price points. A lot of people pulled off the market. There was very limited inventory. You had tenant freeze rent restrictions, right? So you can't evict anyone, which also included, in some cases, utilities. I had single family assets in the state of Washington that your property is secured by the utilities. So if you could, so if the tenants didn't pay the utilities, it's on the landlord, right? So you had utility freezes as well in some counties. All these challenges, but like I've done most of my life, I said, there's got to be an opportunity in this mess. There's got to be a way. We fought through, we followed our numbers, we negotiated a little harder, took a little more time, and we found some assets. As we got those under the umbrella, we realized there was going to be significant challenge with evictions and things like that. But we realized that human nature told us that while there are several people that are going to take advantage of this eviction moratorium, the ones that we really wanted to get out of our assets when we took them over during COVID didn't want any trouble. And they were going to leave as long as we articulated the right way and we put the right systems in. And so being a property management person, because I manage my own individual assets with a property management company, we knew how to craft those documents, right? How to put the right pressure on the people that we knew we needed to get out of there, be it, let's say, a drug dealer or somebody that's causing trouble. The ones that wanted to stay were forthcoming and said, hey, I can't pay. I want to work with you. And we said, great, we'll work with you. Pay 50, 100, do what you can do. Because we knew most of those people were getting assistance in some way, shape, or form and wanted to make it right. We applied the right amount of pressure. We were fortunate that probably 90% of the people on one particular asset that we wanted to get out, there was about 12 of them. There was another maybe four that really were just people that couldn't pay. Those 12 over about a 3-month period pretty much left on their own. We literally only filed one eviction that we lost in court. I think it was in December. And it was because our attorney dropped the ball on some of their paperwork. We actually would have won it because there was a notice to vacate. It had nothing to do with eviction for payment. And so more of a technicality, if you will, right? Other than that, we had a little bit of bad debt. But for the most part, we had underwritten that when we were going into closing and we knew that was going to be there. So we wiped it out. And today we are way outperforming pro forma on that particular asset, even with all the challenges. Class C, value add, rough tenant base, crime. I literally got a call from the lieutenant of the police department that I worked with when we took over, because I went in there, I met with city council and everyone. He called me and he said, Chris, we haven't had a single call in that building for almost 4 months since you guys took over.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And you're bettering the community, right?
Yeah, for sure. Can you share what city that was in? Just curious.
Yeah, that was Savannah, Georgia. And okay. Actually Garden City, which is a little bedroom community right next door to Savannah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, well done. I'm curious if you could share what would be the types of pressure that's appropriate that might, you know, help achieve your aims.
Yeah, that is a great question, because obviously there's laws and rules and these are human beings and we always put the human beings first. We have to make profit and all that. But I'm a firm believer, as people have treated me in the past, I've been a renter, that if you take care of people, you work with them, that they want to genuinely stay and pay and have a roof over their head, right? Nobody wants to move and be going through struggles and have this pressure on them like a collection agency. So what we did is we crafted a few documents that were very well worded. We were fortunate that we had month-to-month leases, which gave us a little more flexibility when we took over. Most people acquire assets in their 6 month, 9 month, 12 month. These were all month to month leases, which meant in our case, we could file a notice to vacate if somebody had not signed a new lease when we took over because they were month to month. And if they didn't come in and they didn't comply, then we could file actually an eviction because they didn't come in and sign a new lease. Even if they weren't paying, they still had to come and sign a new lease because their lease was up every 30 days. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So we were fortunate that literally 6 to 8 people that were troublemakers, they left because they thought we have to go. They actually didn't have to go. They just needed to sign a new 12-month lease and work out something with us. Mm-hmm. But they didn't know that, right?
Yeah, for sure.
So the troublemakers left just by, you know, attrition, I guess. There were a few other tenants where they weren't paying, but they wouldn't communicate, so we didn't know. So by putting good management in place that was vigilant, they would go to the doors every other couple of days. They would email, they would call, they would do all these things that let them know that we are here to stay and we're changing the community, right? Whereas the other landlords just cared about getting low rents and didn't care about taking any care of any deferred maintenance. We dropped about $400,000 in deferred maintenance into that building. We put driveways in, roofs in, cleaning up things. We put signs in, 16 security cameras. We had police there. I even hired private security the first 30 days. We did so much to show that property and the good tenants that we were there to make a difference, including bringing city council in to work with us, that the ruffians, they just left. And again, when I say pressure, indirect pressure, I mean, hey, the good guys are here to make a difference, right? And I got to tell you, Sanjay, that the coolest thing was the last time I was there, I got to see firsthand all the kids playing in our building, running around, people out doing things, barbecues. None of that was going on when we took over this property. I mean, people were like hiding in their apartments, like people just, you know, because the landlords just let people do whatever they wanted to do. We completely turned the asset around. And that's a really good feeling because those are people, good, happy, rent-paying tenants and kids that can be in a property where it's safe, right?
So yeah, that is just such a wonderful story. And it's just such a good reminder. You know, I think a lot of times people, when they think about people who are doing, you know, what we're doing, buying apartment buildings, there's not really the realization that can have a positive impact on the community. But that's actually exactly why what we're doing is profitable, because we're making it into a place that people want to stay and want to be, raise their families and play, live and work. And so it's just, that's just really cool. It's a really beautiful story. So thanks for sharing that.
Of course. Yeah. It's a great feeling.
Yeah, totally. I'm sure it can. I'm sure. I mean, just think about the number of families that whose lives are improved because of the transformation that happened last year. So that's awesome. I'm curious how you were able to handle investor distributions last year. I'm not sure if you had projected any distributions, but how did that go?
Yes. Again, I think a lot of it boils down to grit, tenacity, planning, and following your numbers that you do way ahead of time. It's like that whole iceberg concept, right? What you don't see. And I had 11 months on this asset to negotiate and take time and plan and, of course, adapt and adjust back and forth and go in and out of contract during COVID. It was crazy, right? So for us, one, on all of our assets during COVID, we never missed a distribution payment. Never late, never missed one. As a matter of fact, at the end of the year, per these few assets that we acquired at this time, the way we structured the returns, and I won't get into detail, but the way we structured it was if we overperformed and there was extra revenue, we would bonus in the first quarter of the next year. And on all of our properties, we actually bonused. So even with COVID going on, there was an extra payout, right? And a lot of that boiled down to good planning and good reserves and making sure that when we went into this asset that we had accounted for everything that could possibly happen. And if not, we had extra revenue to offset. And so that's, the COVID process was a little scary. We were a little nervous with the bad debt and all of that, but it really didn't affect us much at all. And a lot of counterparts I've talked to were in the same position. It affected them maybe for a month or two, kind of, and then it came back and they were fine. And now with inflation and rents going up, it's probably going to offset most of that loss. So
Interesting. That's really great to hear how you handled that. And how did you negotiate with this? I'm just curious, like if there's anything you can share about what kind of worked when you were negotiating this particular building, when you were purchasing it, because obviously like COVID happened and how did that go?
I think, Sanjay, we're going to have to schedule about four more podcasts for that one, but I will give you a couple of little nuggets. I actually did a YouTube video on this one. So one thing we did was we put what we called basically a COVID clause in there. And I hadn't heard of anyone doing this before, not that they haven't, but I'd never heard of it. We put in a clause that said, if you have X amount of late or vacancies, late payments or vacancies past a certain amount, we get a certain amount of money for each one of those, right? And in this case, because we thought the seller being a private seller after the brokers and the relationship kind of fell apart a little bit. They were still involved, by the way, brokers got paid and all that, but they just kind of threw their hands up at one point because it took so long and the seller was just really, really difficult. Original owner operator, 35-year-old building, it was really difficult. Seller was in her 80s, her son's trying to help, it was crazy. But basically we put a clause in there that at the end of the sale, we actually maximized that clause. They had to give us an additional $25,000 at the very end. Right? So I'm glad we did that. There were other things like damages and issues. There happened to be a little fire that occurred during the purchase of the property. And so we negotiated, you know, with that. And then he didn't want to up the price. And it was just one unit that was damaged. It was only like a little HVAC child put something in there. It didn't burn anything else. It was actually pretty minor, but he didn't want to negotiate. So he didn't know the costs of everything. And so I was able to leverage my experience and understanding construction cost to negotiate two additional roof replacements, which was about $14,000 in trade for 320 GFCI installs that the lender was requiring. And those installs were only like $8,000, but he didn't know all the differences in cost. And because he tried to pressure me and pulled back on something he said he would do, he literally told me to my face, yes, I lied to you and I'm not going to do what I told you I was going to do. He said that right in the office. And I was pretty shocked, but I guess it's like, well, that's just, I guess, what I'm dealing with here. Then I quickly adjusted and negotiated the roofs versus the GFCIs. And we actually netted an extra, I think it was $6,000. So he thought he was pulling one over, but he didn't know anything about all the costs. And if he would have just been honest with me and said, you know what, I'll do what I said I was going to do, he would have paid for the GFCIs, which was like $8,000, and we would have walked away. But I was fortunate in the way that at that time, the timing was such that my verbal judo worked well and he didn't know enough about it. And we ended up, you know, making a deal. We and the investors benefited. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. Well, that is fascinating. And I'm sure we could talk for hours more about all of the negotiations and just everything about, you know, how this property is working. But we're going to have to close for today, but we'll have you on again soon. Chris, I'd like to shine a spotlight on you. Tell the listeners how they can get a hold of you and anything else you'd like to share.
Oh, that's great. I appreciate it. Well, first of all, we are Sterling Rhino Capital, and we are an investment company that goes out and buys, you know, assets, real estate, new construction, multifamily, things of that sort. We love trying to help people retire early through that concept of passive cash flow and investing. We give a lot of free information away. So even if you're just an aspiring syndicator and want to learn a little bit more, check us out on YouTube at Sterling Rhino Capital. We've got, I think, 60 videos on there now. And I've got a book where I donate all the profits to charity. We fed, I think, almost 300,000 people now. And it's called You've Earned It, How I Refused Anything Less Than Success and You Can Too. I will tell you, it's not a real estate book. It's more a book about my life and building businesses and maybe a little real estate story here and there. But the cool thing is that every dollar that we make goes straight to charity. And as a result, we've fed enough people to fill four football stadiums, which is unbelievable. So that's a little bit about me. Please reach out. We love helping people. We give a ton of content away. If there's anything else I can ever do for any of you, I'm here to help. And thank you so much, Sunja.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Chris. We'll see you next time.
Thank you so much for listening to Passive Income Unlocked. Before you go on to continue with your amazing day, please take a moment to reflect on what you truly desire in life. Then think about one thing you can do to push the ball forward in that direction. Also, please head over to iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts and leave an honest rating and review of this show. It really would mean so much to me. Passive Income Unlocked is brought to you by Lux Capital. Lux works with investors nationwide to invest in real estate. We are closing the investing gap one investor at a time. Connect online at www.lux-cap.com, LUXE-CAP.com, for tons of free educational content to further your success.